Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to Curious Conversations with Tully and Sarah. We sit down and chat with business owners, entrepreneurs, and some of the best conversation starters. This is a podcast about real life lessons and people doing cool shit. Happy Wednesday. Welcome back to Curious Conversations. I'm very naked today because my gal is not here. We're just getting a little practice run from when she's on maternity leave, I feel like. But no, Tull's away. She had a little bit of a medical emergency this morning. So it's just me. And this is what I love to do. Just talk smack. I can talk about conspiracy theories. I can talk about whatever I want. If I had my time, I would probably just do an hour long of talking about the Kate Middleton thing. What's going on? Where is she? That is all my TikTok feed is at the moment. And what else? Jay Shetty, the drama going on with Jay. But unfortunately, you don't have an episode of me just talking smack. I'm not Indy Clinton. I can't sit here for 60 minutes by myself and do that. We have the amazing Zoe Klein on, who sometimes goes by the name Zoe Walker, I just found out, but she's a psychotherapist. And we had a great chat about life, grief. We spoke about grief, which is something we're all going to have to go through in life, loss. I'm probably lucky Tull wasn't here because that's her biggest fear, is losing someone she loves. So we speak about loss. We speak about life. We are so uncomfortable with change, and we speak about the nervous system. So it is a lot about how the brain works, how your brain works, and how to jump into curiosity. So I hope you enjoy it. There's going to be many more of me, more solo episodes of me coming up. So this is just a practice run, but enjoy. It's a great app. Don't forget to go give Zoe some love, and we will see you next Wednesday. Bye. Zoe, you might not know this, but for a while there, you were my favorite yoga teacher.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
You didn't know that. I
didn't.
I loved your classes. I loved the energy that you brought and the, I'd say, questions that you put to the people practicing in the yoga classes. So it makes sense that you are a psychotherapist now. It makes complete sense to me because I felt like in your classes it was so reflective that the two worlds kind of cross over.
Mm. Thank you for tracking my evolution.
We're just talking off camera and we're talking about friendships, relationships. Is there any common theme that you see popping up with clients or just observe in society in general?
Yeah, I get asked this question a lot and it's sort of yes and no. I think the biggest learning that I've had so far in becoming a therapist and sitting down with people week to week and like the largest variety of people is just how different everyone is.
Really?
And how diverse the human experience is and how many varieties of challenge and struggle and adversity and joy and everything in between. And so in terms of pattern recognition, it's like yes and no because there's so much.
As a whole, I know we are so diverse, but is it more consistent with people abandoning themselves to please others, stress? Mm-hmm. What are the big things that you deal with?
Okay, so let's break it down. Relationship issues is massive. People feeling confused in relationship, dissatisfied in relationship, tolerating toxic relationships, unable to find relationships. So that's sort of a category in itself and something that I'm super interested in.
Yeah.
Burnout, stress, overworking, poor boundaries, and that applies to relationships but also the workplace. So
I feel like we're going to dive into a conversation we just had off air because yeah. You were like, oh, the classic, you tolerate the behavior. I'm like, oh, fuck yes, I know you're right. When you talk about relationships, you don't just talk about sexual ones. It's friendships, it's any relationship, right?
In terms of patterns in therapy, I'm usually talking about intimate relationships. Mm. But the interesting thing is that people come to therapy to talk about their intimate relationship. And the question that I like to, I guess, mirror or reflect back to people is, well, where else is this pattern present? Because what is happening in your intimate relationship, it's very likely that that same pattern is playing out in potentially subtler ways in all of your relationships.
Can you give me an example?
So let's say that you enter into an intimate relationship, you have really poor boundaries, you're a people pleaser, and you let your partner walk all over you. They're the boss. They wear the pants. Mm. They decide what you're doing on the weekend. They decide the trajectory of your life. And then, you know, that same person might start to reflect on their friendships and actually recognize, oh, wow, I'm never the one to decide where we go for dinner, or I am never the one to lead a conversation, or, you know, this is such a petty example, but you can sort of see that when someone has a way of being inside a relationship, then that typically is their way of being in the world, because the way that we develop and grow as a human being is through relationship, through our primary caregiving experience. So the way that our parents or whoever is taking care of us when we're young, you know, that is the first model of relationship. And then we grow and develop off that. And so it's like this classic thing of the way we do one thing is typically the way that we do everything.
So with an example of someone who becomes a people pleaser in a relationship, going back to their childhood, naturally what would have been the relationship with their parents? Like, would they try to compete for their love, or, I don't know, were they only given love when they achieved something? So
there are obviously, you know, this is incredibly complex, but for the purposes of simplicity in this moment, we'll just give one example. Really often a child might grow up in an environment that's incredibly tense. Maybe there's marital issues. Maybe there is issues with another sibling. Maybe there is just, for whatever reason, some kind of tension inside of the family system. And we all develop strategies in order to manage the, you know, tension and anxiety that we feel. And one of those strategies is just to make sure that everyone else is okay. Because if I make sure that mum's relaxed and dad's relaxed and my sister has everything that she needs, then there's going to be less tension. I'm not going to be contributing to the problem.
People aren't going to fight.
Exactly. And the less people fight, the less anxious I feel, the more calm I am, and the more safe I feel, essentially. Yep. It's all about safety. And so, yeah, the classic people pleaser learns that to maintain a feeling of safety inside of their body, they need to make sure that everyone else around them is all good, which mitigates any potential for disruption or stress.
How do people change that if they want to?
First becoming aware of it,
starting
to actually understand, oh, I do that.
Yeah.
You know.
But is it necessarily a bad thing?
Everything's on a spectrum. You know, you can think about everything on a spectrum. Is it bad to be anxious? No. Mm. Anxiety is a really important feature of our biology that keeps us safe. Is it good to be feeling chronically anxious all the time at the top end of the spectrum? No. You know, in terms of people pleasing, is it okay to actually want to make sure the people around us feel happy, healthy, and safe? Of course. But when that comes at the expense of our own needs, no, you know,
right.
And you know, the classic analogy, which bores me every time I say it, but being on the airplane, you know, you have to put your own gas mask on first before you can help the person next to you. If you're giving from an empty cup, if you're pleasing everyone around you and completely burning out because of that, then that's going to have really detrimental effects on your well-being.
How do people get to know themselves?
Depends what you're into.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, there's so many different ways, and this probably crosses over into the intersection between yoga and therapy, which I know you wanted to talk about. How do people get to know themselves? To, you know, essentially becoming self-reflective, and there are so many different practices and ways that we can be self-reflective. One of them is yoga.
Yeah.
You know, you can be self-reflective through journaling. You can be self-reflective through therapy, and I'm sure that, you know, there's a number of other ways of doing it as well.
But, okay, I've got a fair few people in my life that don't take accountability, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like they really lack that ability to be reflective. Mm-hmm. And I used to be one of those people.
Yeah.
Why are some people not reflective? Is that a narcissist?
Okay, let's leave the narcissist question to the side, because that's
loaded.
Yes and no. So why are people not reflective?
Mm.
Not to oversimplify things or to kind of harp on the childhood piece, but I think realistically I really take this perspective of understanding human development.
Yeah.
If we grow up in an environment which does not encourage self-reflection, then it's going to be pretty unlikely that we cultivate the capacity for self-reflection.
Oh.
I think as a culture, we aren't overly reflective, especially the generations above us.
Yep.
And so, again, comes back to this piece around we learn how to be in the world through these really early relationships. And, you know, it's pretty complicated.
But what you're saying makes sense to me, because if I think back to my childhood and my parents, no way in hell would they have the ability to sit down and be like, I'm sorry how I behaved. It's because I was feeling this.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I've never had to, until I've gone out to therapy myself, had to sit down and be like, why the hell did I just blow up at someone?
Yeah.
And then I expect them to, and I see it with people now in my life, that they blow up and then the next minute they think it's fine, like, oh, well. They'll get over it.
Yeah. People are running on autopilot.
Yeah. Fully.
And like ourselves included, right? Like I am on autopilot a lot of the time. And that, you know, exactly right. Who teaches us to actually pause and take a moment to check in with what's happening internally, our emotional state, our mental state, you know, whatever else, our physical state. You know, when we don't get taught to do that, or when it's not modeled to us, then why would we do that?
Yeah.
How would we know how to do that until something happens which actually invites some glimmer of reflection that lets you know, hey, maybe there's something in this that is to do with me. So does
people don't like that though.
Exactly. So like, to the accountability piece, right?
A lot of people are like, hey, I'm not the problem, it's you. That's how you're behaving. But in reality, if you're there, the problem is you, whether you're tolerating the behavior or if you're throwing it out.
Yeah. Comes, but you know, to use the people pleaser example, if you're like, God,
I'm a big people pleaser.
Why do all of my relationships, people just walk all over me all the time, you know, da 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 da. Every single person that I attract just walks all over me and I'm doing everything. It's like, well, you know, we have compassion for that because there are really good reasons, remembering that that person really is just trying to keep themselves safe. It's how they know how to do that. But what's the common denominator here? You know,
I'm just thinking of the example in my head. Like, I've had conflict with a girlfriend for the last like couple of weeks, and I don't think I'm in the wrong.
Mm-hmm.
She doesn't think she's in the wrong. I've acknowledged my part, but I'm so uncomfortable with the, do I call it not distance, but the, I feel like I have to fix the situation still.
Yeah, the tension.
Yep, the tension. Tension is a great word. I don't know how to sit with tension. And so that's when the people pleasing comes out. It's like, oh, I'll do this for you. I'll do that for you.
Yeah.
But I know that I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But it's like, okay, I need to, I don't know, if it's something to feel loved, I don't know, it's something I probably have to reflect on. But it's also a trait that I'm trying to get, not get rid of, but I don't want to be that people pleaser anymore. I know I've done nothing wrong. Friendships are hard.
They are hard. But this really comes down to emotional regulation, this idea of feeling challenged by sitting in tension. It's like, well, what are the skills and the tools that you have that help you to regulate that state, that actually help you just to hold the feeling of tension and kind of being okay with it? What we resist persists.
Okay.
The more that we resist tension, the more that we try to maybe quell it by just fixing the situation, it's fine, I'm fine, everything's fine, don't even worry about it, I'm not even angry at you, it's all good. You know, then what does that do in the long
run? How do you sit in it?
You figure out your own personal tools and strategies that help you to increase your capacity to hold discomfort in your body.
E.g.?
example,
yeah,
rather than distracting yourself through scrolling on your phone or having a wine or whatever else it might be, just actually sitting down and feeling what you're feeling. You know, the classic name it to tame it, you know, name the emotion to tame the emotion. What am I actually feeling right now? Oh, wow, I'm feeling frustration. This person has really crossed my boundary. This person has really pushed in on a wound that feels really raw for me.
Yeah. That is so funny you say that, because I went to kinesiology yesterday and he's like, oh, your heart's out of – he's like, your heart and your liver. He's like, someone's making you angry, but they've broken your heart. I'm like, mm-hmm.
Oh.
And he's like, but it goes back to childhood. I said, I can tell you the exact moment when I was – he's like, it's when you're seven. I said, I can tell you the exact moment, and it's with my dad. Oh, so the body, like, this is the old classic, the body keeps score.
Body keeps score, yeah. And so to your, you know, the accountability piece.
Yeah.
That's why we really need to hold this understanding that a relationship by definition is at least more than one person.
Yeah.
Interpersonal relationships are two people coming together with their own unique bodies and patterns and wounds that just interact with one another. And so to take accountability is to recognize that, yes, what that person said might have been from something that they've experienced, you know, and some lack of regulation in themselves, but that's actually touched something in me that's caused me to react in a certain way. And that's the accountability piece. But it's all held under this big umbrella of compassion, in that I'm doing the best I can with the experiences that I've had and the wounds that are still open for me, but so is this other person. Because they've also had unique experiences that I literally cannot relate to, because it's impossible to understand someone else's subjective experience in its totality. And so it's this dance. All relationships are these dances, you know, your pattern and my pattern interacting with one another.
Yes.
And, you know,
how do you, I don't want to say tolerate it, but if you're aware of it, then how do you deal with it?
Well, like, in what sense?
So we were saying before, and you're like, oh, you're the classic tolerator. Why am I tolerating it? Is it because I have the inability to set boundaries?
Maybe. You tell me. Why do you tolerate?
Okay. It's questions you have to ask yourself.
Yeah.
Why do people tolerate toxic relationships?
I mean, there's no one answer to that. You know,
like, to feel loved,
that's layered.
Or...
yeah. Well, some people have only ever experienced toxic relationships, and we gravitate towards what's familiar.
Oh.
You know, if your family environment, your home environment was incredibly toxic and disruptive, then there's, you know, a really high chance that you're going to go out and move into the world either recreating that pattern or seeking out that pattern in some way.
Wow.
Yeah.
So someone who, okay. I see all those things come up on TikTok, and it's like, if you're a kid that's this, if you're a person that does this, then this is because the child within you.
Yeah, and yes, but it's so complex.
I know, isn't it?
Yeah.
But what are some, like, someone listening, apart from just reflective questions, how can you, to reflect, you probably need to be honest. Do you have to admit, one, that you probably just want a better life?
Well, I mean, let's talk a little bit about change.
Yeah.
So firstly, for any change to happen, there needs to be some level of acknowledgement that there is something in the first place that needs to change.
Oh,
and usually that happens because something happens, which again gives that little glimmer of, wow, maybe there's something that I'm doing that's making my life harder than it needs to be. If we think about changing relational patterns, and the work of therapy is that the therapeutic relationship acts as a safe, non-toxic, open, trusting relationship in which not only our mind but our bodies can learn a new way of being. And so it's like, well, I notice myself constantly stuck in toxic relationships, and I recognize now that's because that was has always been my experience. I grew up in a toxic environment.
Mm-hmm.
Then I need to go and seek out a relationship in which my body can learn a new way.
That's so uncomfortable.
Of being. Yeah, it is uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But can you imagine what the feeling would be like on the other side?
Whoa. My favorite saying over the other side of fear is freedom.
Yeah, freedom. Mm. Like the number of people that I get the privilege of sitting with week to week who feel hopeless when they first enter into my now virtual office.
Yeah.
And, you know, coming out the other side of that, and I like to take really regular check-ins around progress to make sure that we're always feeling like we're on direction and moving towards the goals, which are constantly changing, of course. But to have those moments when we check in and the person is able to reflect and be like, my whole life has fully changed.
Do you know what I feel like therapy does, and this self-awareness? Not everyone needs to go, well, people should, but a level of yoga can give you a level of self-awareness.
For sure, no doubt.
It is like you're running on autopilot with nothing going on in your head. Mm-hmm. And then like a little computer program's like, nope, this is what's happening. This is why you're doing it. And it's like you're awake for the first time.
Mm.
You're awake, like you're awakened to your thoughts, your beliefs. And like I said to you before when we're out in the other room, I was like, last year it just clicked for me.
Mm.
This whole world of yoga, therapy, my thoughts was the first time I was like, I get it. Oh, your thoughts are your beliefs.
Mm.
I think I said I couldn't do something. And then I was like, your mate, I was like, why the fuck did you say that, Sarah? I was like, that is the worst language to use to yourself. Mm. But it was the first time I've caught myself. I'm like, oh, I have the my brain's been saying that to me for the last 30 odd years just on autopilot.
Yeah.
With no self-awareness.
And I often like to ask the question, which might sound a little bit obscure, but whose voice is that?
Exactly. Whose is it?
You know, where'd you pick that one up?
Yeah, I don't know. But where did you? Is it been just layers and layers that people have put on you and conditioned you for the years prior?
Mm. Yeah.
And then it's like, okay, so I became aware of my thoughts, and then I was like, oh, I kind of get it now. I get manifestation. A thought repeated enough time becomes a belief.
Mm.
A belief is how you move in life, but if you put something out there enough, that's manifestation.
Mm.
You attract what you believe.
That's it.
So it's just becoming aware of your thoughts.
Well, again, that sort of oversimplifies it. That is a massive part of it.
Yeah.
But there's a difference between a cognitive belief and an embodied belief, because we can at times rationally believe and know something.
So an embodied would be like a subconscious belief that your body naturally reacts to something.
Yeah. Yeah. Like what is your, to put it in more, you know, woo-woo language, like what's going on in your subconscious? We can consciously decide,
let's go woo-woo.
I deserve to be successful.
Mm.
But if we have, what's the statistic? I don't even know where this comes from, but people often say, you know, you're running off your 95%, which is your subconscious, and the 5% of your life is conscious.
Mm.
So we can have a really adult, logical, prefrontal cortex.
That is 5% of the day.
You know, that is great and rational and helpful, but actually the majority of our life is being run by what's happening in the background. And what's happening in the background is more of these kind of, you know, the body is the storehouse of experience. And so what's, you know, these wounds that still live in the body are going to dictate how it is that we expect the world around us to be. And that is, you know, we have core beliefs around ourselves, around others, and around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a compilation of all of our life experiences that still live inside of us. And until we have the courage to look at perhaps some of our adverse experiences or, you know, some of the context in which those beliefs came to feel true, then it's pretty unlikely that they're just going to go away.
Are those beliefs that are subconscious from, say, one traumatic event in childhood?
It can be, not necessarily, no. It can be so many things.
Yeah,
It can be a series of it can be so many things.
You could have been abandoned several times as a kid, or it could have just been one time you felt lost at the supermarket.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're talking about like a lifetime of experience.
You know,
that it all, and that's why we're so unique, because no one ever has the same path that has been walked.
So you're the head side, right? The therapy side. That's the head.
No.
Oh, you're the body
because
side.
Therapy is ineffective if you just use your head. If you're just talking, if you're just being cognitive, if you're just using the frontal lobe of your brain, then you're only going to be talking in this really logical space. But what we know through so much research actually is that change needs to happen from the top down. So the way that our thoughts influence the body, so understanding our beliefs, the narrative in our head, the story we tell ourselves about ourselves, but it also has to come from the bottom up. From the bottom to the mind, which is the more somatic practices to actually get out of the mind and into the body. And that's when like magical things happen. That's when, you know, you
breath work.
Oh. You know, breath work as one example, but there are so many therapeutic practices that are really, you know, as we would call it in clinical language, bottom up.
So right. That makes sense to me. So you can go to therapy for years and years and years, but if you're not doing anything to heal the nervous system.
If you're just talking and not actually feeling anything, nothing's going to change. No, not nothing, right? Not nothing. It's still. I'd rather
it's
you guys go
progress.
And do that.
It's still progress.
Than nothing.
Yeah,
but
right.
Yeah, like it really, in my experience and through what I know and have learned, you know, you really have to be integrating these two things together because we are an embodied process. We experience the world through our bodies. I think it's something like our bodies are moving 4,000 times faster than our thinking mind. So there needs to be a kind of, you got to feel it to heal it.
Yeah, okay. So whether that's like doing breath work, doing, I don't know, what else would you do? Somatic, like, you know, that.
Yeah, there's like
flipping on the ground and stuff to heal you.
These ones.
You know, the flipping on the ground, you know, rock from side to side to get the trauma out. People say trauma sits
trauma
in your
release
hips and all that kind of stuff.
We're really throwing out these one-liners. Heal it to feel it. Trauma sits in your hips. But yeah, exactly right. Like, there are so many trauma processing practices, somatic therapies. Anything that kind of works with the nervous system is helpful. And it's
so like acupuncture, Reiki, kinesiology, all these things.
I mean, I personally like to take a really holistic view of well-being because, you know, obviously I've been a yoga teacher for far longer than I've been a therapist.
Yeah.
You know, there are so many different modalities, but yeah, taking a holistic perspective really is this understanding that the mind and the body are the same thing.
Okay. This is just making so much sense to me, especially after yesterday when my chiro and kinesiologist said about my heart and my liver. I said to him, where does that – he goes, we have to release the energy in your heart and the blockage in that. I said, where does it go though? I was like, explain it to me. He's like, well, your body will use that energy. He's like, if there's a blockage somewhere else, it will go there. But if not, it's released and you will use it.
Mm.
And he's like, the whole point of all these – healing remedies is to basically rewire your nervous system.
Mm. Yeah, and what does that actually mean?
Yeah.
To feel safe inside yourself, to get out of a state of fight, flight, which we are all spending majority of our waking life in because we're stressed and we've had all these experiences that no one talks about and,
you know,
and the rest. And so, yeah, to create a balanced nervous system is to feel safe and at ease inside of our body.
That time of week again, guys. It is the Chemist Warehouse Pick of the Week and I'm doing this ep solo, so it is just me and it's quite fitting because everyone knows I am on a hair care journey. Anything that looks after your hair, I'm all in for it. And this Chlorane dry shampoo is the newest thing that I've added to my rotation. There's a thing called ceramides that I keep seeing around in skincare. And they've put ceramide-like into this product. And what it is lipids that help retain moisture in your skin. And the scalp is an extension of your skin. So a healthy scalp equals healthy hair. There's also a oat extract in this to help protect your hair and soften your hair. So if you are after soft, healthy, luscious hair, this is for you. Dry shampoo. Get it at your local Chemist Warehouse. How do you do that?
Heaps of therapy.
Okay. All right.
No. I'm
heaps of therapy, but also like…
Develop a relationship with your body fundamentally.
How do you do that?
Through practices that get you out of your mind and into your feeling state.
Say, for example, yoga. If I was in one of your yoga classes, it can be like a really fiery class.
Mm-hmm.
and say, you're making me hold like warrior pose for ages. One thing that always sticks in my head with yoga teachers is for when they say, what are you thinking? What are you feeling? Sit into your body.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the time it's like, fuck, why am I holding this pose? I can't hold it any longer. When they're fucking going to change it? I'm like, oh, so is that what you mean? Like sink into your body and then be like, oh no, my shoulders are up. Why are my shoulders up?
Mm.
Oh, my hips are really tight. Why are my hips tight?
Mm.
Is that what you mean?
Like the key to understanding anything, whether it's another person or our own bodies, is curiosity. Like how can I enter into any moment in my life, whether it's holding a yoga posture, whether it's sitting in meditation, whether it's walking down the street, just with an element of curiosity, because to be curious is to be self-reflective.
Mm.
When we say self-reflective, it's like, what does that mean? Am I just reflecting on my mind or am I reflecting on my feeling state in my body? Ideally, we develop the capacity to do both, which is, again, really the purpose of sitting in therapy. It's like we can't – I want you to be self-reflective on your mind. I want you to understand that your thoughts aren't reality and that you don't have to believe the things that, you know, randomly enter into your mind. But I also want you to be reflective of the way that that thought makes you feel.
And what, where that feeling comes up in your body.
Yeah, exactly. And where that sits inside of you, because really often when we actually pause for long enough to sit in the tension of something to yep. come full circle,
yeah.
that really often what happens is that it sort of dissolves, you know, feel it to heal it, baby.
And do you know what? This is a perfect segue because when I am, I don't know if sad's the right word, but do you know when people get that lump behind their throat and they're like, you know what, I can't cry right now, I can't cry.
Mm.
Is that because you don't let yourself feel it?
You tell me.
Well, perfect example. Yeah, okay, yeah, I wasn't letting myself feel it because I didn't want to see people see that I was upset. Okay, all right, cool.
Look at you being all reflective.
Yeah. What about grief? Because that's something I've wanted to speak with a professional about for a long time because there's so much for me fear around grief because that means I've lost something, whether it's a friendship, whether it's a relationship, whether it's a loved one. How do you navigate grief?
Big question.
Yep.
So, I mean, there's probably two ways that I could answer this from a therapeutic perspective, but also from a personal perspective. And it probably feels more, authentic to speak from a personal perspective. Mm. So, you know, I had not much experience with grief actually until only a couple of years ago. And so if you'd asked me this question a couple of years ago, I would have said grief. I don't know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, as you know, 5 years ago, my dad passed away in an accident, a car accident, and completely shattered my entire world, as I know that anyone who's lost a parent can relate to. And it was in that moment that I potentially for the first time kind of cognitively understood, this is what grief is like. And what is grief? Well, grief is loss.
Mm.
Grief is loss. And what a messy but also beautiful and profound experience grief is. And I think
that you just said beautiful experience.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I can say this now because it's a couple years on and, you know, time has certainly passed. But there is something so beautiful about grief. And I think that as a culture, so to sort of answer your question around, you know, navigating grief, I don't think that we as a culture hold much reverence for loss and grief. And I think that that is really, really a disservice, actually. You know, to be alive is to die. Life is contrast. Life is polarity. To be alive is to die.
Mm-hmm.
And so to come into contact with grief is actually to come into full contact with our aliveness. And I think for me personally, until I had experienced grief, I took my aliveness for granted. And there is something about acknowledging that and also, you know, the daily remembrance of that that keeps me so grateful and just fucking stoked to be here.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
It's like that saying that you get two lives. You get your life when you're living, and then you get your second life when you realize that you only got one life.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Dealing with grief as someone who's experienced such a profound loss, if Tal was here, she'd be like, that's her biggest fear in life. Mm. How do you feel it? It will obviously never go away, but the volume of it, does it change? Like, I think people have the perception of time heals, but that's not necessarily when it comes to grief.
Yeah, you often hear that idea that the grief doesn't change, you just learn how to live your life around it.
Yeah.
Life expands around it. I often reflect on that in my own experience and sort of try to rub that up against my own reality. And I don't think I've fully reconciled that yet. Yes, I do think that that's true.
Mm.
You know, that grief, it certainly doesn't go away. Does it stay the same size and your life just expands around it? Maybe. But I do, you know, in my experience, time has certainly helped to heal some of the wounds. You know, it's especially in the context of losing a parent. You know, how old was I at the time? Maybe 26. You know, the gear shift that needs to take place in order to cope and respond to such a massive change in the family system, but also just in the context of you being a daughter and a child, is massive. But I think that there is something to say for adjustment. You know, and in many ways, I've probably said this before, I feel like my entire life prepared me for that moment, for that phone call. My entire experience of finding my yoga practice, finding my meditation practice, becoming self-reflective. I had been in therapy a little bit before that. That there was something in my bones that sort of knew that I'm okay. And it sounds kind of maybe weird to say this, but there's also a part of me that there's a tiny glimmer in the background that can actually find gratitude, A, for what I mentioned before, this idea of feeling so alive and so grateful for life, but also in my independence, because my dad and I were so close. He was my mentor. He was the person I would go to for every single question. You know, we would speak multiple times a day, and you know, he really shaped who I am as a person, but as a businesswoman, and so many things in between. And I think one of the hardest parts of losing him was like, oh my God, now I have to do this on my own. I have to now decide what I want for myself, and I don't have that voice that I can bump up against and help.
Yeah, the board of directors.
Yeah,
of dad,
exactly.
Giving you advice.
And
yeah.
And even though I still very much grapple with that, and sometimes I just so badly need to ask his opinion on something, but I think what a beautiful experience in coming into myself and coming into my own independence, and actually, fundamentally, we're all alone. Fundamentally, the only person inside of ourselves is ourselves. And you know, I think that for me, again, I can only speak personally, there's been so much growth in, you know, recognizing that I need to take control of my own life, and that now I am in control of my own life. And it's hard, but also that's freedom.
And you're, like you just said, you probably realize that you've always been in charge of your own life.
Exactly.
Yeah. Impermanence is such a – why do people have fear impermanence? I've got a quote about this, but I want to hear your thoughts.
Why do people have a fear of impermanence? I don't know. We put so much effort into building ourselves inside of this reality and building our identity and our ego and our personality and everything that fits inside of it, that it feels terrifying to have to kind of admit that at one point that will be totally relinquished. Maybe. I don't know. I don't know if I have an answer to the question.
I saw a beautiful quote, and you know Minaj,
mm-hmm.
One of my favorite yoga gurus now. He's got the Open app, and mm-hmm. we're talking about impermanence.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought up this beautiful quote because he's dealing with grief and feeling grief in a really strong way at the moment. And the beautiful quote was, it's not that we are afraid of the unknown.
Mm.
It's that we're afraid of the known ending.
Oof, yeah.
Hits nice. Hard, huh?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. My God, that is so true.
Mm.
Whenever I'm sad, whenever I'm going through change, any kind of change, and there's some kind of resistance, it's not because I don't know what's on the other side. It's just because my little fucking comfort zone is coming to an end. And I'm like, boy. No, cool. I like this little cocoon that I'm in, that I know what things are going to happen.
Mm.
But that's not where growth happens. And I know that, but it's so hard to sit in that uncomfortableness of, okay, I'm going to lose loved ones. I'm going to have to readjust when things change. Tally's going to have to readjust to life having a baby now, and that's a huge change for her.
Mm.
That's what I think about impermanence. I'm like, it's just the fear of the known coming to an end.
Yeah. Yeah, we're creatures of comfort. We like familiarity because it helps us to feel safe. You know, it's safe when it's known.
Okay. You know? But then that's when the nervous system comes in.
Mm.
But is it safe? If you're wired in fight or flight, and in your comfort zone, your body's telling you you're not safe.
Yes, but if that's our comfortable set point, then that just is.
Okay.
Yeah.
You mentioned something before, and I want to pick your brain about this
because
it's something that's brought up in yoga so much, but it's so interesting to me, the human brain, ego. Mm. It's something that's thrown around in yoga all the time when teachers talk about ego. What's ego?
Ego is the story that we tell ourselves about ourselves.
Okay.
I think.
I don't know, but so like in a yoga context, when would you throw around ego?
Well, in a yoga context, when would I throw around the word ego? I wouldn't because I think that the word ego can be confusing. But I guess if we think about, well, what is yoga? You know, yoga is a set of practices. Yoga is a science that was originally constructed and designed to cease the cycles of suffering, recognizing that when we are in a state, an egoic state, when we are in a belief that our thoughts are truth and that the story that we tell ourselves about ourselves is reality, we suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And the practices of yoga are designed to recognize, you know, practices that help us to recognize that actually we are the witnesses of everything that is happening. We are, you know, with enough conscious intention, able to rest back into our experience and actually watch ourselves think and actually watch life move by. And it's from that place that we recognize that actually I don't have to be attached to the way that I'm thinking. I actually don't have to be attached to anything at all because I'm just in the background. I'm just consciousness experiencing itself.
Just observing.
I'm just observing. Oh. And so to be in a state of ego is to be, no, you know, I am right. I am truthful. This is the way things are.
And, okay.
You know, the way that we think, the way that we experience reality is just the way that we perceive reality to be true. And so
I've learned that. I've learned that my filter is completely different to your filter.
That's it.
You can say one thing, but because my filter in my brain's wired a certain way because of all these things, I take it a certain way.
Mm, exactly right. Yeah, and that is based off our unique life experiences.
Yep.
The shade of my glasses that I wear that color the world and the way that I see it is going to be dependent on my entire life and all of those experiences and the ones that still feel open in my body and you know, and yours will be totally different.
And we think that people feel emotions the same way we do, which is probably the biggest misconception ever.
Yeah.
Especially in relationships with your partner that you're when you're fighting, I don't know, and you get pissed off about something, you think that they're pissed off is you're pissed off, whereas they probably came from a place of love, whatever they did, but it's just the way we filter things in our own mind.
You might have pink glasses on and I might have blue glasses on.
Yeah. You know, who knows?
And that's why curiosity always wins.
Mm.
What if in a moment like that, instead of just reacting and kind of getting caught up in the tension of the moment, it was like, hey, what's actually going on for you right now?
And in that reaction, it's something, a feeling happens, the body reacts, the mouth reacts generally. Yeah. That's what happens. That's the process.
Yeah. And so the idea with, you know, even a practice like yoga is to recognize that actually if I can just relax back enough, I can actually create a gap space, a moment in time that gives me the ability to not just react, you know, or be respond. Reactive, but actually to take a moment of pause, to be actually reflective enough to be curious about what's actually happening in me right now. What has this just triggered inside of me that's making me want to erupt? Is that actually about the person in front of me, or is that something that's happening inside of myself? And likewise, what if I could be reflective enough to put myself in that person's shoes and actually think about what might be going on for them at the moment, so that instead of reacting from a place of rage, I can actually hold a quality of compassion of, wow, that person, this person who potentially I love is really experiencing something right now.
I'll give you a very good example and the people listening.
Hit me.
Tal's partner, Damien, he sent me a beautiful message the other night.
Mm-hmm.
We were having a great D&M. I left.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, I forgot to tell you one of my favorite things of how I view life.
Hmm.
And I was like, okay. And I was reading it and he's like, say you're sitting at the traffic lights and it goes green and the person in front of you doesn't go and you get real aggressive and too. He goes, it really frustrates me when I see people do that.
Mm.
He goes, because who knows what that person's going through. They might have just got a phone call from or be on the phone to one of their friends, their mum, who's just been diagnosed with cancer. They could be going through the most horrendous thing, like a divorce that time. And I was like, that is a really beautiful way to, for me, he's so patient, but empathetic, where he's like, just don't worry about it. It's not a big deal if someone moves at the lights or not. Like, who knows what other people are going through?
And how much more relaxed inside of yourself do you feel when you take that perspective of empathy and compassion?
Yeah.
Oh, God, now all of a sudden I don't have to hold this rage in my body.
True.
And I can just kind of be, and I can just be totally okay with what's happening here in this moment.
Huh.
God, I feel relaxed just thinking about it.
You also run female retreats, yeah?
I do.
What is the theme of those retreats?
So I run a yearly retreat in Sri Lanka, and the retreat is around slowing down fundamentally and kind of recognizing that one of the patterns that I see and experience both in myself and in others is this idea of being in the rat race on the hamster wheel and being totally burnt out. I think that because there is so much pressure, you know, through social media and just where we are at as a culture, to be something, to be successful, to be productive, to be efficient or whatever it might be, that, you know, people don't actually have the time to pause and take these curious moments, you know, these moments of self-reflection. And so I offer the space through fundamentally the practice of yoga. You know, it is a yoga retreat, but also I weave in the themes of self-reflection. And my hope is to give people a week of time in which they're completely removed from their external circumstances. Most people come alone. Some people come with friends or family, but you're outside of the context of your regular relationships, and you can actually just have some breathing space to pause and take a moment to ask yourself the important questions. What path am I walking on right now? You know, so often people are climbing up these ladders and they get to the top and it's like, oh, fuck, it was against the wrong wall.
That's
the classic saying.
Yeah.
And it's sort of a really beautiful opportunity for people's nervous systems to be able to just kind of relax into just being and not doing so much. But also, and I didn't speak to this right at the beginning when you asked about patterns, but loneliness. Loneliness is what I really am witnessing so much of. People are really, really, really lonely. And loneliness is interesting because people tend to think, oh, well, you can't be lonely. Look at you. You've got a partner and maybe you've got kids and you've got friends around you, but there's a real, you know, there are different types of loneliness. You can be in an intimate relationship and still feel incredibly lonely.
What's the difference between lonely and alone?
in your world.
Lonely is a feeling, whereas being alone, you know, could be interpreted as, you know, a situational moment in time.
Yeah.
The feeling of loneliness is a feeling.
Is that would be that like, no one cares about you, that you don't have a support network, that it's just you?
Yeah, like who is attending to my – who is showing interest and curiosity into my internal landscape and my emotional state, and who is helping me to feel cared for? Who is helping me to feel like I'm of value? You know, just because I'm sitting next to someone, that doesn't mean that they're making me feel love or feel cared for. And, you know, we're social creatures, you know, human beings, we're social creatures. We need community for survival. We would not survive by ourselves.
Yep.
And so the feeling of loneliness, you know, people are saying it's like being lonely is like smoking a deck of cigarettes a day or something. It's like crazy.
It's that bad for your
health. Really, really bad. Yeah. Oh. And so, to come back to retreats, the intention of that is connection. Mm. Like really, you know, it's hard to make friends as an adult.
100%.
And so I, you know, bring people together who I know have similar interests because, you know, at the very least they're into yoga and they're willing to be self-reflective in some way. And to watch people come alive in new relationships is like, oh, you can feel the healing of it. Mm. And especially when it's all women. My retreats aren't always all women, but it kind of typically – it tends to be that way.
With someone who's feeling lonely and that no one's caring to their needs, going back to what you said before, we're all alone.
We are all alone.
So the first person who has to care about your needs and your values yourself?
Absolutely. 150%.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. But we also exist through connection.
Yeah.
And so we need real, authentic connection.
Mm-hmm.
And that is hard to find. Authenticity can be hard to find because we all believe that we're supposed to be doing a certain thing and doing it in a certain way in order to be liked and in order to have friends and have community. But if we're doing that in a way that's inauthentic, it's very likely we'll continue to feel lonely.
Because there's a distance between like your body will know that you're being inauthentic.
Well, it's an extrinsic motivation instead of an intrinsic one. I'm doing this because I think it's what other people think that I should be doing and it's going to make me have some kind of status or make me feel like I belong. But the paradox of that is that actually if that's not coming from an internal motivation of what I actually feel is right for myself, then it's not going to feel fulfilling in the long run. You know, it might work for a small amount of time.
Yeah, right. That makes total sense to me.
Mm.
And people-pleasing 101.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it.
Is there an epidemic of people-pleasing? That's if it's coming down to loneliness, do you find that they go hand in hand?
Yes.
Yep, okay.
Yeah.
Well, people-pleasing is a abandonment of yourself.
Correct.
Okay. Yeah. So if someone's listening and they're a people-pleaser, it's time to reflect on why you're doing so much for others. Yeah. Is it to be loved?
But you can be a people pleaser and still have people in your life who are really showing you their interest and their care.
Mm.
Whether you're able to receive it or not is different. But I think that the experience of people pleasing and loneliness can absolutely go hand in hand, but I don't think that they're mutually exclusive. Like I don't think that it's as clear cut as that. But I don't know, what's your experience of loneliness as you call yourself a classic people pleaser?
I don't know if I've ever really felt lonely.
Mm.
Like I live alone. I do a lot of, I recharge alone.
Mm-hmm.
But do you know what? When I felt my most lonely is probably when I ran away and lived in Italy when I was younger because I was running away from my problems.
Mm.
So I knew I was abandoning myself and I thought running away to a different country would fix me, but it was like, I know shit, then my problems follow me everywhere. So that's when I felt most lonely was when I was so disconnected from myself. I had no direction. I didn't know what to do. I don't want to say I didn't like myself, but like my first love and I like broke up and I didn't feel worthy.
Mm.
That's when I felt lonely.
Yeah. And if you don't, if people don't feel worthy of love,
yep.
it's pretty hard to receive love.
Mm.
They're,
okay. That makes sense.
Mm.
So it's the old saying like, okay, I know that saying, to receive love, you have to love yourself kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Yep. All right. I understand that. No, but going on, like you were speaking before about love and how you might be with a partner, but how they're giving you love, you don't receive love. It comes down to love languages. But it, being reflective in my life and spending more time with my dad as an adult than I did as a child, I always didn't feel loved by him because I wanted to receive love in a certain way and I wasn't getting it that way. But then as an adult getting to know him, I was like, oh, my God, he was showing me so much love in his own way, but I just wasn't receiving it. So I had to heal those wounds of thinking I had to receive love in a love looked like this. I'm like, love doesn't look like that. Love looks can look like a bloody rainbow of different colours from different people.
Yes, and
you know, what problem do I have now?
No, I just it's an interesting reflection. As a child, it's certainly no child's responsibility to have a preference for the way that they would like. You know, things are a lot more black and white as a child, and I guess it's really imperative to feel not only loved as a child but attuned to. And ideally, in a parent-child relationship, the parent is attuned to the child in a way that lets them know how the child needs to be loved from moment to moment because it changes. You know, this idea of love languages, it's like, yes, but that's also a pretty adult, logical way of explaining the receiving and giving of love. I think fundamentally, if again we bring it back to child development, a child needs to feel unconditionally loved always. And that requires a lot of emotional maturity from a parent to be able to give that. And, you know, there's no such thing as the perfect parent. They don't exist.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone is doing the best they can with the experiences that they've had and the love that they've received and the resources that they have at the time. But, you know, it should never be on the child to let the parent know how they need to be loved. Really, that responsibility in an ideal world is on the parent to be attuned enough to their child to understand how it is that they need to be loved in any given moment.
From observation of having nieces and nephew, I feel like kids just want quality time. That's all they want from their parents.
Oh, yeah.
That's all they want and they need.
Yeah, quality time and presence. Which kind of these go hand in hand, but presence within that quality time, like really to
off your phone,
to feel felt,
okay,
to feel as though this person is
sees my emotions, understands
this person is with me, not physically, this person is with me. I feel safe, I feel seen, I feel heard, I feel mirrored. You know, we come to understand our own emotional landscape through our parents' ability to mirror things back to us. And that's where we learn to be reflective. And it's subtle, like good parenting. And I, just to be really clear, am not a parent. But this, you know, good parenting is not about buying extravagant gifts and giving, you know, really privileged lifestyles. Those things are nice and they're really helpful, but actually it's about attunement. How sensitive am I to the needs of my child? How sensitive am I to be able to read their emotional landscape before they're able to read it themselves? Because my ability to read it will help their capacity to start to understand it. And that's how we grow into mature, emotionally regulated, reflective beings.
Oh, okay.
And I don't know about you, but I don't know that many people who have had that experience.
No. And like you said earlier, it's the generation of our parents, they were not brought up with it. So it's kind of like, okay, there has to be someone in the family generation that
changes. And that's why therapy is so courageous because, you know, it a lot of this stuff is really generational. Mm-hmm. People are just passing down the patterns of their own experiences. And it does. It takes courage to be the one to be like, this isn't working for me. This isn't working for us, actually.
Yep.
But I am going to have enough courage to be the one to go and look at it and face it and feel what might have never been felt before.
No. So where can people find you then, Zoe?
So my therapy practice is called Loop, yep. Loop Wellbeing. I work 100% virtually mm-hmm. at the moment. So people can find me there. Also, I am having a slight identity crisis at the moment. So some people out there might know me as Zoe Klein,
yep.
which is my maiden name and very much my soul identity.
Yeah.
But my therapy identity is typically Zoe Walker, which okay. is my non-official married name. I haven't done anything legally and can't decide if I can be bothered to or not.
There's a lot of paperwork involved in that.
A lot of paperwork. Yeah. Don't know if I've got the time for it. But anyway, welcome to my identity crisis, everyone. So Zoe Klein or Zoe Walker, it just depends on the day.
All right. Well, hit her up because, you know, after all this, I realise, shit, we still got a lot of work to do.
And you and me both.
Yeah. Thanks, Zoe.
Thanks.
It's us again. We're back. It's Tully and Sarah. And if you don't know, we have an activewear brand called Tully Lou.
And we have Australia's favourite leggings. But not only do we have leggings, we've got hoodies, we've got outerwear.
We've got everything that you may need for an active lifestyle. So we want to give you guys an offer if you've never shopped at Tully Lou or if you've shopped at Tully Lou
and you just want $15 off your next order,
you need to take this offer.
And it's TL Cherry, all caps, all one word, and pop that in at checkout and you will get $15 off.
So head to our website. It's www.tallyloo.com or head to our Instagram, stalk our page, use the code and let's get you all in some TL.
And welcome to the family.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.